You ever think about quitting?
It's the combat of life hammering the snot out of you.
Well, stand by, dig in deep, and get ready to get fired up with us.
Welcome to the Team Never Quit podcast, the number one podcast that inspires you to fight on. I'm your host, David Rutt Rutherford, here with Mr. Never Quit himself, Marcus Luttrell.
Our mission is to help you embrace the suck of life, to teach you the values of working your ass off, and to interview the most hard-charging people on planet Earth.
We know life is hard. It's time for you to suck it up, Buttercup, and let us teach you to persevere in every environment imaginable by sharing real-world lessons learned by those who never quit. That's right. It's time, Marcus, for us to help them defeat the negative insurgency in their lives.
You fire me up. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Let's roll.
Let's roll. Dirty deeds done dirt cheap. Dirty deeds done dirt cheap. Marcus Luttrell, what's the worst job you ever had? Worst job. Go.
Oh, shingling a house in the summertime.
In Texas.
Yep.
Oh, that's horrible.
Maybe throwing hay in West Texas. But I was young, so
all right, now
thinking about it now sucks. Even worse. But I'd have to say I never did it, but laying asphalt road out in West Texas in the summertime would probably be the most miserable.
No, the what it's you've got one
my,
you
my
did.
Personally went, oh, shingling a
shingling roof. What made it suck so bad?
It had rained the day before and they didn't cover the bags with the tarp, so they were all wet and saturated. Remember how little bitty we were in high school. It's me and Mojo.
Right.
And it didn't have that fancy ladder deal or whatnot. We had to carry the bags up the ladder.
Right.
I would get about halfway up, then bags start splitting, and the shingles would fall out. I'll never forget, Morgan was standing underneath me, and those shingles were falling. I mean, ripping us apart, bro.
Yeah.
And the guy who we were out there working for, he's laughing. I mean, he can carry five of them up there at the same time. But it took us all day to get those bags up. Every one of them would rip. And I think there's one part Morgan was like, man, just let me go.
Just let me go, baby. All right, Wizard. Your worst job you ever had?
Oh, let's see. I worked in the body shop in Lordstown Assembly Plant building cars for General Motors. And the monotony drove me crazy. 3 miles of cars, and they'd come along. I got to the point where I was hanging several jobs, but the one my least favorite, was hanging gas doors. And it involved this whole process where you had a form and different nuts and rivets and a torque gun and all this stuff. And you'd get so bored, I would close my eyes, identify the car, it's moving down the line, by touch, go back to my station, pick up all the equipment I needed, go find the car again, mount the gas door, and repeat over and over and over and see how many I could do in a row.
With your eyes closed?
With my eyes closed.
That would drive me insane.
Yeah, there might be a few mismatched gas doors on Chevrolet products.
That's one of the most impressive things to watch on YouTube is people proficient at their job, like just what they're capable of. See, when the boxes are coming over, those two ladies are sitting there and they're not even looking, they're just stacking the boxes up, and especially the cooks.
Yep.
Man, and on that assembly line, I bet you get to where you can just and next.
You got to do something to keep your mind occupied.
Oh, my God. Sure. Mine? Distributing beer, dude. I worked on the beer trip. My cousin, the thesis, they owned the Miller distributorships from like Vero all the way down in Key West. And so they gave me a summer job before I went to college, man. And I worked on the beer trucks. And you had to be in there at 4:30 in the morning. You got the manifest. And then so I'm thinking, you know, I love to drink. I love to party. This is going to be epic. You know, you go to a bar. You take in a couple cases. You have a couple pops all day on the beach in Fort Lauderdale. You can't beat this, right? No, you could beat it by far. It was horrific, dude. Summertime, South Florida, full uniform, polyester, hauling on grocery days, on Publix days, we'd take in 1,500, 2,000 cases of
beer.
You
also had to build
That's a great workout.
The pallets. You had to stack the pallets.
Morgan did that with Coca-Cola one summer, and he said it was the same thing.
Horrific, dude.
Hard work.
And so, like, instead of it being done in half the time, I'd do the whole thing, right? And the worst were where you go into the back areas in the supermarkets where they wouldn't have, you know, where some other distributors are like Budweiser or someone else, they took your spot and just stacked your. So they're like, hey, bro, you got to go in there and move all their stuff over there. Then you got to put your stuff in there. And then you got to go and stack the fridge. And I'd be like, what? Wait, what? Oh, bro. It was horrible.
I got a bad stacking story. You were talking about baling hay and trying to be on a wagon before you're big enough to keep up with whoever's driving the tractor because it's spitting it off on the baler. You're too big to pick these bales up with one hand, and you're sweating in the summertime, and you're cut up from all the hay. It's like having a million grass cuts on you. That's some hard work.
Oh, bro. You think about how many hard, debilitating jobs there are in this country that makes our country function. It's nuts, dude.
Yeah, well, we know somebody who's seen a fair share of them.
And that's why he is coming on this show, baby, because the guy who's coming on today, Mr. Dirty Jobs himself, Mike Rowe, could be. I mean, I have been hounding them for like a year. And what's crazy is, dude, apparently, like, right when I sent in the first one, Marcus, like a year ago, it came right back. They're like, oh, dude, he totally wants to do the show. But the guy is doing.
In a sewer pipe right now.
Yeah, he's in a sewer pipe. Right. Wait till he does like Dirty Jobs Around the World. Where they're still doing jobs from like 200 years ago, right? Welcome to the TNQ Dirty Jobs Show. No, just kidding. Welcome to the Team Never Quit podcast. I'm your host, David Rutt Rutherford. I'm here with Mr. Never Quit himself, Marcus Luttrell, and the Wizard.
Thank you.
Is that cool?
Exorcist kind of.
Yeah, right? That's what I was going with. Thank you, brother. Thank you for acknowledging that. I was tapping into some dark places on that, dude.
Boy, she freaked me out in that movie, man. Did you see?
Oh. Head goes
I saw
around.
It when I was a kid. You know, the babysitter let us watch it with while the parents were out.
Bro.
Messed me up.
Dude, forever.
To this day, I think that's the only scary movie I've ever seen.
The Shining? You haven't seen The Shining, dude? Red Rum.
Great movie. Not
really.
Not truly scary, in my opinion.
Dude, yeah, man, if you go back and watch that head twisting around, it looks fake.
You don't forget that.
Oh, she comes down the stairs upside down.
Yeah. Back in the day.
But I digress. Welcome to the TNQ podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. If this is your first time out with us, man, God bless you. We are so stoked. This is going to be a treat for you. This show is going to be awesome. You are going to learn stuff you can't even imagine about the Never Quit mindset right now. If you're a repeat offender, God bless you. Right, Marcus? Yeah. I mean, seriously, we're genuine podcasters right now because of them.
Can you believe that?
This is our job. Talk about great jobs.
They didn't even have that listed on a form most of our lives.
Didn't know that was an option.
You know what is I mean? You can't, yeah, what do you want to be when you grow up? Remember
the school days?
With a guidance counselor?
Yeah.
This wasn't on there.
No, it didn't exist. Because there was radio show hosts, but you had to, different.
You had to have the Mike Rowe voice.
Yeah, you did. But us, we can do whatever. That's what I love. I love the freedom of it and the opportunities that we have to be able to bring these incredible guests on to share with you, our listeners, to help you overcome obstacles, to face adversity, to knock the negative insurgency right square in its nose, and to stay in the fight, man, to find something of meaning in your life so you can make a difference, so you can have passion in what you choose to do for a living, man, and that's what this show is all about. If you want to know more about us, don't hesitate. Go to tnqpodcast.com, visit the site. You'll be able to see our entire back catalog of shows and listen right there. And you'll also find out why we're doing it. We have this great community built in. And if you get a wild hair, man, we would love it if you wrote in and shared your greatest never quit story, baby. Because I'll tell you what, we are starting to compile a huge community of those now, aren't we?
Yeah, we're somewhere around like 15 pages of stories on the website right now. It just grows every day.
Oh, my God. So Go there. Tell us your greatest never quit. Hell, tell your greatest never quit story about your grandfather, your father, your uncle, your mom, your sister, your aunt, your uncle, your brother. We don't.
Yeah, there's no age limit on this one.
No. Anybody. We don't care. Share these great never quit stories about the people that had the greatest impact on you and your life that taught you the never quit mindset. Because, man, that's what we're trying to build here. It is that epic community. All right. If you're fired up and you really dig us, man, we got some epic new T-shirts and other swag for you. So don't hesitate to go there. We would love your support. You buy swag. Those. Swag.
Great
swag.
Word.
Swaggy.
Swag.
Swaggy.
Some people got more swag than others.
Oh, man, we got swag for you. Yes. All right. Also, if you want to follow us, we finally could talk the wizard into getting on social media.
You gotta get people stalking you down, bro.
Oh, yeah. It's the wizard TNQ. Search that. You'll find him. You can follow me at Team Frog Logic. And, of course, Mr. Never Quit himself at Marcus Luttrell. Okay. Okay, baby. Let's get Oh, man, this is epic, bro. Are you ready?
I've been excited about this since you first said that Mike wanted to come on.
Yep. Dude, right? You same, Marcus?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Oh, man. There's something about him that just he's, you know.
I catch myself watching the show sometimes, not even paying attention to what he's doing. I'm just listening to him talk.
His voice. Yeah. He's got right? one of the coolest right? voices ever. Like, it makes you want to listen because you know he's going to tell you something cool.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, only. Exactly. You know he's got cool stories because of the way his voice sounds.
Oh, that's why I love his that podcast. Yeah,
that's why
man.
I got him made in that way.
Right?
He had a voice because he knew he was going to have cool stories.
Well, or did he have the voice and realize he needed to go get cool stories to utilize the voice?
No, Marcus definitely had it right.
Yeah.
Thanks. I was just blow me away on that one, man. You know, I've got hard enough time keeping up as it is.
All right, Wizard, let's get a bio on this man, please.
Yeah, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to unabashedly plagiarized right from his bio because
God bless
it's written really well. And I'm going to read it, and you're going to be entertained. Mike Rowe is a TV host, writer, narrator, producer, actor, and spokesman. His performing career began in 84 when he faked his way into the Baltimore Opera to get his union card and meet girls, both of which he accomplished during the performance of Rigoletto. His transition to television occurred in 1990 when, in order to settle a bet, he auditioned for the QVC shopping channel and was promptly hired after talking about a pencil for nearly 8 minutes. There, he worked the graveyard shift for 3 years, also being fired 3 times, mainly due to making fun of the products and belittling viewers. Thanks to QVC, Mike became practicing the art of talking for long periods of time without saying anything of substance at all, a skill that would serve him well as a TV host. Throughout the 90s, Mike had hundreds of jobs, relishing his role as a chronic freelancer with lots of time to loaf around. Then, through a horrible miscalculation, he pitched a 3-hour special to the Discovery Channel, which ended up resulting in the show Dirty Minds.
Dirty Minds? Where's your fucking head at?
Let's go. What are you watching?
Dirty Minds. He's going, dude. He's been away from his lady for 70 days, bro.
That's right.
70 days.
We're getting actually getting close to 90 days.
90.
Anyway, he pitched a 3-hour special to the Discovery Channel that ended up resulting in the show Dirty Jobs.
I've been snapping at everybody the whole damn week.
There are reasons for this. Viewers liked it, and Discovery responded by ordering 39 episodes, a shocking commitment that Mike was contractually obligated to honor. For the first time in his career, Mike went to work with a vengeance. Over the next decade, Mike would become known as the dirtiest man on TV. He traveled to all 50 states, completed 300 different jobs, transforming cable television into a landscape of swamps, sewers, ice roads, coal mines, oil derricks, crab boats, hillbillies, and lumberjack camps. For this, he received both credit and blame. Looking for a simpler way to make the rent, Mike went to seek out opportunities that didn't require multiple showers. He narrated hundreds of documentaries about space, nature, war, serial killers. If there's a wildebeest getting eaten alive by a lion, it's probably Mike that's going to be telling you about it. As a public speaker, he's routinely hired by Fortune 500 companies to frighten employees with stories of maggot farmers and sheep castrators. And when Madison Avenue came calling, Mike said, sure, and has since filmed over approximately 1 million Ford commercials. Eventually, Mike was overcome by a strange desire to give something back. On Labor Day of 2008, He launched Micro Works, a PR campaign designed to reinvigorate the skilled trades. He's since written extensively about the country's relationship with work, the widening skills gap, offshore manufacturing, infrastructure decline, currency devaluation, and several other topics for which he has actually no credentials. In May of 2011, he testified before the U.S. Senate Commerce Committee about the importance of changing perspectives and stereotypes around blue-collar work, and was asked back to testify again by the House in 2014. He runs the Micro Works Foundation, which awards scholarships to students pursuing a career in skilled trades. He is closely associated with Future Farmers of America, Skills USA, the Boy Scouts, and he actually himself earned Eagle Scout as a young man.
He was the top Eagle Scout.
He was the top Eagle Scout?
Yeah, I think he was the top Eagle Scout. He got awarded that.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
And Forbes has identified Mike as one of the country's top... one of the country's 10 most trustworthy celebrities in 2010, 11, and 12. Now, just three things that he's currently working on, because he has a resume that goes on for miles in his
latest
TV
stuff
and narration and all this stuff. But
hit
what
the
he's
numbers
doing right
too,
now,
baby. Hit the numbers.
All right. So right now, his TV show, Somebody's Got to Do It, is in its second season. It's a blockbuster success. It brings viewers face-to-face with men and women who march the beat of a different drum, paying honor to innovators, do-gooders, entrepreneurs. It's a show about purpose, passion, and occasionally hobbies that get out of control. He's on Returning the Favor. This is a Facebook watch phenomenon. It's over 226 million views, featuring people who give back to their communities. And he has a really interesting podcast, The Way I Heard It. It's titled The Way I Heard It. It's for, as it says here, the curious mind with a short attention span.
That's awesome.
It'll soon release its 100th episode, and it's been downloaded over 60 million times at this point.
Dude, that's massive, bro. Because it's his voice, dude, I'm telling you. And he brings just positive content to people. He's a positive dude. Even what I love is when he gets attacked online for supporting certain things, and you know, the haters out there, I mean, you get slayed by them all the time, but he keeps this positive spin about it, man, and keeps bringing people back to the center of what's important and what makes America strong. I love him, man.
You're on point, man. It's a unique perspective that he has. I can't wait to hear it.
It's awesome. What do you say? Let's bring Old Mike Rowe on the show, baby. Dirty Deeds. Done dirty. Now, Marcus, I'm going to tell you, brother, you and I and the Wizard, we have been in some dirty spots. We have been, you know, we've sucked in so much fecal particulate downrange in both Afghanistan and Iraq. I mean, hell, the stuff we've had to do, the harbors we've had to dive in. But I'm telling you what, brother, this guy today who's coming on takes that whole concept to a whole nother level. And he knows. He's not one of the guys who just sits out and says, wow, that looks horrible. He gets in the muck. He's in the filth. And what I love most about him, brother, is this guy cares about the dude that does it day in and day out, bro.
And does it with a smile on his face.
That's crazy.
If you're not laughing, guys, the joke's on you.
So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, welcome to the Team Never Quit podcast, Mr. Dirty Jobs himself, Mike Rowe.
My God, that was beautiful, Dave. I hope I can give an interview half as worthy as the introduction you've just given me.
That's a hell of a compliment coming from him.
That is one of the greatest ones I've ever had, that's for sure, man.
We'll make it into a ringtone for you and send it over.
Oh, great.
He's like, great. I was just joking.
Well, sir, I can't even begin to tell you, we've all been so excited. You know, we've been working hard with your guy Chuck for about a year to get you on. We understand, man, how busy you are, how much good you're doing in the world. So for you to come on and join us to help support our listeners and the people who are struggling out there, we just can't thank you enough, sir.
Look, all I can say is, A, you're welcome, and B, the privilege is mine. I've wanted to do this from the first time you guys reached out, but you know the drill. It's 10 pounds of crap in a 5-pound bag, and we're running in 1,000 different directions, and it's just hard. It's so crazy how difficult simple things become when when you get a little lucky. And all of a sudden, you're just that guy, you know, calling in from airports and writing stories on planes and really living in the cracks. I'm not complaining, but it's just a hell of a thing that you really can never anticipate. But next thing you know, there you are in the middle of the day on the phone with three heroes, and it's really a thrill for me. So let's be fascinating together, shall we?
Let's be fascinating together. All right. So in order to be fascinating, we first have to get warmed up a little. We gotta stretch out. We gotta dig in. And I got to tell you, of all of our guests so far, you're the one that I'm, you know, after I read the whole thing about you on QVC and being able to talk for 8 minutes about a pencil, I was like, there is no...
A man after my own heart. That's what he said. My God. God, it's me.
I'm like,
it was a hell of a pencil, Dave. It was a hell of a pencil.
You're like my total role model in my life now to be able to do that. And so, you know, in order for us to get in, we've got to start out, get a little rapport, get a little a welcoming to you by doing the Mad Minute with you. So if you're ready, if you're fired up, we're going to jump in.
Let's do it, man. Whatever it is, it sounds fantastic.
All right, Marcus Luttrell, go ahead, start out. Fire away.
All right, brother, a movie character you'd like to play out in real life for a day.
Oh, wow. I'm going to go with Winston Churchill, as long as I get to pick the day.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You mean me for a whole day or any day in his life?
Any day in his life.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I would have to think... Being Winston Churchill, like the day after Dunkirk, would have been amazing, knowing you got those guys out. But you know what? Is this like a multiple choice thing? Can I give you another one?
It's a free-for-all. Go.
So there's a character called Travis McGee that was made famous by an author named John D. McDonald, and he appears in 20 different Pulp Fiction mysteries. And back in the 70s, they made a movie about this guy. Sam Elliott played the main role. But Travis McGee is a guy who I based my entire business model on. And he's one of my favorite characters of all time. Sadly, he's fictitious, but I love the guy. He lives on a houseboat, and he basically is sort of like a mercenary that people hire who have been swindled, and he goes and he gets their stuff back, and he keeps half because he's a mercenary.
Right.
But he's it's such a great character, and it broke my heart because it was such a shitty movie, but the books are so terrific that if you take anything, I don't know what we're going to talk about over the next hour, but if your listeners love to read The Deep Blue Goodbye by John D. McDonald, starring Travis McGee. You'll love it.
Dude, what? That's awesome, man. Yep. Hey, don't we know a guy who's a contractor, lives on a houseboat? Isn't that tiny, I think?
Everybody knows
the
guy.
Yeah, right? Everybody. All right, Wizard, fire away.
All right, Mike, give us one job that you would assign to your arch enemy, assuming you have an arch enemy.
We did 300 dirty jobs over 9 years when we were in production.
Wow.
And there's only one that I would never do again. And I guess that would be the answer to your question. If I really wanted to put somebody through the ninth level of hell, I would send them to Coober Pedy, Australia, in the middle of the outback, and have them mine for opals.
Oh.
Mining for opals. This job, I mean, you were talking about feces from every species before, crawling through the muck, diving in the crap. I get all that. You know, we've done that. You guys have been there and done it. But mining for opals requires you to be lowered on a bosun's chair into a shaft the size of a manhole that's 80 feet deep. And as you're slowly lowered into this pit of despair, your job is to look for traces of opal, which typically occur between deposits of sandstone and soapstone about 60 feet down. And if you find it, then they haul you up and they dig another hole, and you keep verifying the vein, and then you eventually dig out the hillside, and then you get rich, you know, collecting opals. But the business of finding opals in the 128 degree outback, being lowered into these awful claustrophobic pits. Guys, when you're 80 feet down, standing on the bottom of this shaft, looking up, the aperture at the top, it's like a pinhole. It's just a little piece of blue, and the dirt is touching your shoulders. And the only upside is it's cool. But you know, every year they don't fill these holes in, right? So ostriches and kangaroo, they're always falling in these holes, and they're thousands of them.
Oh,
really?
And 2 days before I got there, a tourist fell in. When he was taking a picture of the moron, and he backed up and he fell in head first, broke his shoulder. Broke his leg and stayed there upside down in the bottom of this shaft for 70 hours.
Oh my God!
Wow. When they hauled him out finally, he lived, but he was unable to speak and never got his voice back. He was so traumatized.
Oh yeah, nope, that's good. I'm not doing that one.
No, you don't do it. Just saying no.
That work.
Sometimes it's okay to quit.
Yeah, yeah. On that one, I would ring out in a heartbeat on that one. Like, I mean, holy cow. All right, here's a question now. One of the coolest things I found was that I found out that you went to Overly High. And my best friend from Penn State that I play lacrosse with, he was from Overly, and we would go down there, and we would eat crabs all the time. So what is the best place to eat crabs in the Baltimore area?
Wow. All right. So you got a place called Obrecki's, which has been there for about 1,000 years, and they still do a great job because they don't go out of control with the filler. What you want is back fin from a Maryland blue crab. You don't want the claws, and you don't want the filler, and you don't want the bread. You want Calanectus sabbatus. Latin for Chesapeake blue crab, and you want it. You want them broiled. You want them about the size of a baseball. You want it with some corn on the cob, maybe. And as you eat it, you just want to congratulate yourself for ordering the finest food available on planet Earth. Now, if you're not going to go with a crab cake, you know, and if you're just going to go with the crabs themselves. Well, then you can also congratulate yourself because you've ordered the perfect food, because it's difficult and delicious. You can't eat crabs fast. You got to crack them open. These things are nautical Rubik's cubes, right? And they're just filled with thousands of little compartments of delectable meat, and you can either eat as you go or you can stack the meat up on the side. All you have to really do is make sure you're drinking National Bohemian beer while you're cracking Natty the crabs Bo. On newspaper. And look, my mother, you know, she's a very, very particular woman. She's very sophisticated, but when she eats crabs, it's like she's a drunken crack whore, right? The food's flying through the air, it's stuck in her hair. My father says you can learn everything you need to know about a person by the way they eat Maryland blue crabs, and I believe the old man is correct.
100%.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
That sounds good. I'll take one.
Yeah, right?
All time.
Marcus, you got to think about it in terms of the Old Bay seasoning, too, right? So these things are covered in Old Bay, and when you eat them, you're going to cut your hands. It's guaranteed. And the Old Bay gets into the cut.
Burn.
And it stings so freaking bad, you'll whimper. But it tastes so good, you can't help but keep eating. And so that's the kind of balance of pleasure and pain that ultimately has defined my career. And I firmly encourage your viewers, as they're reading Travis McGee, to eat Maryland blue crab and wrap themselves in the warm embrace of cognitive dissonance.
Euphoria between the tears.
Warm embrace of cognitive dissonance.
I'm just going to think about the waiter, his voice. I mean, because if you were standing above me telling me about today's special, I'd have got everything you just talked about.
know what I mean? That's where I zoned out. So I was like, man, we're here right now. That's real good.
My mouth is watering right now. All right, Marcus, fire away. That was epic.
Best dive bar.
Wow. There's a place in San Francisco called Grumpy's. It's one of a thousand dumps that I love. And the reason I love Grumpy's is because in 2001, I was working for CBS, and I had an idea for a segment called Somebody's Got to Do It, which ultimately led to Dirty Jobs. And I went down to Grumpy's to write it down so I could present it properly to my boss. And it was just, it's one of those bars where your feet stick to the the floor just a little, where you can throw peanut shells on the ground, where you can order a decent hamburger and drink draft beer. You can sit inside or outside. You can throw darts. And it's just a weird mix of pirates and hippies and pretty much everything you want in a dump.
Oh, God bless Grumpy's, man. I'm going, dude.
Who's not allowed in the other bars?
Yeah, right?
Where's that place? That's Grumpy's. That's Grumpy's. Yeah, we're getting there.
All right, Wizard, fire away.
Give us one of your favorite quotes.
All right. Well, in the interest of Travis McGee, he said in one of the early books, be wary of all earnestness.
Ooh.
And, you know, I never gave it a lot of thought at the time. But as I got older, I realized earnestness is it's different than sincerity. It's sort of the thing you do if you need to fake it.
Right.
So, you know, newscasters are earnest, or at least they appear that way.
Right.
Pitchmen, like me, you know, I can be earnest if I need to. The viewer and the listener should always be wary of people who say things like, you know, well, if I'm being honest, or can I tell you the truth? Because the truth is they probably can't. So, yeah, I'm going to go with be wary of all earnest. Or, you know what? Henry Ford had a good one. He said, chop your own wood. It'll warm you twice.
Nice. Nice.
I dig that.
I love that one.
That's cool.
I love it. That is epic right there.
I watched that
man.
Ford documentary the other day. I remember that quote. It was
that's
pretty
good,
sharp.
Isn't
yeah,
it?
That's good stuff.
That's a good one.
All right, Marcus, last question, fire away.
Favorite superhero?
I always thought Wonder Woman was kind of hot.
Especially now,
dude,
Gal Gadot.
Yeah. She does such a great job on that. Just get it on.
No, she was terrific.
Oh my
god!
No,
there's something about that lasso—the lasso of truth. You know, I mean, the superheroes are all the rage, and yeah, it'd be great to fly, and it'd be great to be invisible, and all that other stuff. But man, how handy would it be just to wrap half the characters up who are running the country right now in the lasso of truth?
Oh,
and,
amen.
And get them talking.
Amen to that, Mike. I think that's the majority of America's quest right now. That would be the greatest battle of all day to get everybody to actually start talking to each other and talking with the truth, man.
Dude,
all right.
I would actually dress like Wonder Woman if I could have the last word of truth.
Wait a minute.
Oh, I know what we're sending you, buddy. I know what we're sending to MicroWorks. Stand by to stand by. Awesome. Well, that is the Mad 11 Minutes. And, man, I'm telling you, those my opinion, best answers we've ever had. So thank you, sir.
Oh, you flatter me. Thank you.
Very being earnest.
Yeah,
I'm being
earnest.
Earnest.
Being
wait,
earnest.
That's tight. That's
he's
not
being
what,
earnest. Yeah, be wary of that.
Watch that.
They always say that about me, Mike. All right. All right. So we appreciate it. But now it's time. Let's pivot a little bit. And obviously, the reason why people come to the Team Never Quit podcast is because they're facing some adversity. They're trying to figure out how to get over those obstacles, whether you know, it's some kind of trauma in their life, or it's they're unhappy at their job, or, you know, just life isn't going the way that they had hoped it would. And so they come here to hear our guests tell their incredible stories about perseverance, about grit, you know, managing the pain of life with a smile on their face. So, Mike, without further ado, sir, would you please share your greatest never quit story or stories with our listeners?
Well, aside from the fact that it took me a year to actually get on your show, you know, regarding perseverance, that's up there for sure. I stuck with it. Now here we are.
We appreciate that.
You know, I guess I'll tell you a good one, but I should preface it by saying from, you know, my whole career, from that crazy run at QVC all the way up until 2001 when I pitched Dirty Jobs, was actually, you know, it was kind of based on quitting. This is sort of a confession. Quitting's probably the wrong word, but my business model didn't require me to swing for the fences. You know, I was a percentage hitter, and I was a host. You know, mm-hmm. I impersonated experts on television. That was my job. You know, so I was pretty good at it. You know, after 3 years of selling crap in the middle of the night on QVC, I was able to create the illusion of expertise and competence in short bursts, which is exactly what you need to do if you want to freelance in nonfiction. So I hosted shows and did horrible infomercials for a long time and typically looked for projects that were so poorly conceived and such bad ideas on their face that no amount of luck or talent could possibly save them. So I would attach myself to these turds and get paid for doing what I do. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, you know, the whole thing would crap the bed and it would be canceled or, you know, because none of these shows deserve to work. And long story short, I found a way to prosper. I mean, I wasn't killing it, but I was comfortable with failure because I really didn't care too much Wow. about the fame. Well, all of that went out the window in 2001 when my mother called me at CBS, where I was working at the time, and said, look, your grandfather is dying. He was 92. Man. And, you know, he was my idol. He built the house I was born in without a blueprint. He only went to the seventh grade. But the guy, you probably know people like this. You mm-hmm. probably are people like this. You know, you could take a watch apart and put it together blindfolded. He could, you know, he was a master electrician, steam fitter, pipe fitter, welder, mechanic. He just had that chip, you know,
right.
that allowed him to fix anything. And here I was singing in the opera and doing all sorts of crazy crap on television. And he would turn the TV on and see me and shake his head and, like, you know, throw a Budweiser. You know, so my mother calls me. I'm sitting there at QVC and she says, Michael, your grandfather's not doing well. And I just think it would be terrific if before he dies, he could turn on the television and see you doing something that looked like work.
Wow.
Thanks, and so,
God bless her.
Like, Jesus. My mom killed me. So
they don't pull any punches, moms.
Yeah. Yeah. No, she always called it the way it was. And of course she was right. And I thought, you know, I was hosting this show at the time called Evening Magazine. And I went to my boss and I said, look, why does this show always have to come from, you know, a winery or a theater or some San Francisco hotspot? Why can't it come from a factory floor or a construction site or a sewer? You know, and my boss is like, look, nobody's watching the damn show. Do whatever you want. So I said, great. And that's why I wound up over at Grumpy's drinking draft beer, writing up the treatment for Dirty Jobs.
Wow.
And to answer your question, honestly, the hardest thing I ever did was getting Dirty Jobs on the air. Because, you know, I got a pilot on the little show at CBS that I was doing, and they fired me the next day. the whole thing took place in a sewer. You know, I mean, I literally dragged the viewer through a sewer in San Francisco with a sewer inspector, you know, replacing bricks. And we were just covered with tampons and condoms and crap. And it was just the whole place. It was like a German porno, you know. I mean, it was awful.
Sounds like bliss.
But it was really fun. It was fun, and the guy was great, and I thought it was great TV, but CBS fired me, and I spent the next year taking the footage of me in a sewer around Hollywood and hearing no in every imaginable way from every network. You know, it was too gross for PBS. It wasn't gross enough for Fox. It was too funny for NBC, not funny enough for Comedy Central. I mean, nobody wanted this thing. And by the time I finally got to Discovery, they didn't want it either, but they ordered 3 hours to kind of hold together a larger relationship
that
they were interested in pursuing. But getting Dirty Jobs on the air forced me to really become something else. Rather than a host, I had to become a really kind of a guest, to be honest with you.
Right.
And after impersonating a host for 15 years, suddenly I was realizing that the key to that show working was humility. And I had
I had to let
the experts truly be the experts. I had to not be wary of, I had to let it go. You know, I had to let all that earnestness go. I had to let all of the fakery go. And, you know, I told Discovery, look, I don't want to do a show with second takes. I don't want writers. I don't want producers. I want a crew that goes with me into the opal mine, into the sewer. I want it to be as honest as we can, you know? And so we wound up hiring a documentary camera that essentially chronicled the making of that show.
Wow.
So, you know, to finally unlock that whole thing was a lot like eating a Maryland blue crab, you know?
Right.
You had to embrace a certain level of pain. You had to do everything differently than you were used to doing it. And ultimately, you know, I had to admit that everything I thought I knew about my own industry, you know, hosting TV shows, was wrong. Dirty Jobs, aside from being a complete spectacle, was also a really, really honest look at the way a lot of people earn a living. And it was packed with not just lessons, but the Greeks call it a peripeteia. You know, it's like it's the moment in Oedipus Rex, for instance, when Oedipus realizes, you know, the woman he's been having children with and sleeping with is his mother. It's a realization that changes the course of the narrative, you know. And I know a lot of guys in the service who always want to talk to me about their own peripatetic moments when they realized, shit, you know something? I was so sure, and now I'm so wrong. It's like that moment in The Sixth Sense. Remember Bruce Willis?
Mm-hmm.
Right? So in the beginning, you know, he's introduced to Cole. And Cole is obviously mentally troubled. He's a little kid who sees dead people. And along the way, Bruce Willis starts to realize, you know, this kid might not be crazy. And by the end, he realizes he's absolutely not crazy. And he knows that because
he's dead.
Dead.
Yeah.
He's been dead the whole damn movie, right?
Wow, absolutely. So,
great twist, by the way, in that movie. It was awesome.
It was awesome. All great literature, all great stories have a moment where the protagonist realizes everything he thought he knew
was wrong.
You know, Aristotle said the very definition of tragedy is that moment when the protagonist comes face to face with the undeniable truth of his own identity. And so
Amen. The
business of never quitting, you know, to me, you know, it's always it has to be an honest search for what it is you've gotten wrong. And
great, beautiful.
Plus, it's fun.
Beautifully put. What I love most about
the discovery of yourself.
Yeah. Right. Marcus, it is. It's that awakening saying, man, what I thought I know, it doesn't exist, and now I'm beginning to know. But the even better is what propels you to then begin the true search for information, right? And that's what life is about, is seeking the truth, you know, understanding why am I here and what purpose do I serve? My favorite aspect of Dirty Jobs, because I was a fan from the beginning, is how we got to know the people that were the specialists. And I think tell us, did it happen right off the bat that you recognized that was the beautiful aspect of the show, was these people and that was the focus?
Well, getting the focus off of me and onto the unpredictable was the hard thing, because look, TV is a very, it's a very derivative business. You know, executives and producers, they don't greenlight shows that they don't understand.
Right.
And they don't understand shows that they haven't already seen. Mm-hmm. So there was nothing on the air like Dirty Jobs in 2001. There was no real reality TV except Survivor, and that wasn't necessarily real. So the idea of going into a sewer with a crew and pointing the cameras at somebody who had never been on TV before. You know, we went to towns you can't find on maps to interview people you didn't know existed who did jobs you didn't know were around.
Wow.
And, you know, to come out of the gate with the opposite of celebrity, that was scary for producers. And to get people to genuinely trust you, there's just, you can't cheat, you know. You have to do the work. And that was the real son of a bitch for me in Dirty Jobs, you know, because my whole industry is based on cheating.
Right.
But on that show, I couldn't do it. I had to try, and I had to fail. So ultimately, the reason it worked is the viewer got to see me in a kind of Groundhog Day moment. Right,
right. I mean, right.
Like, every episode is my first day on the job. And
your misery, your pain, right?
Yes, that's it. Yep. That's it. But, and this to me was the beautiful part of the show, the people that we profiled 9 out of 10 times were doing jobs that we grew up thinking were things to avoid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great moment when, you know, when a family sits down to watch a TV show and sees people doing something truly difficult, dangerous, or distasteful while they're laughing.
Yeah.
And this is the thing that made people's heads explode. They just didn't talk about cognitive dissonance, right?
Right.
Why is everybody on Dirty Jobs having so much fun? What what do they know that we don't? Or what do they know that we've forgotten? And the truth is, guys, it's, you know, it's probably a question you've had too. You know, why do people want to be Navy SEALs? I mean, beyond patriotism or service, what is it in some people that, you know, allows them to want to push themselves into a place of willful discomfort? Why do people line up on the docks in Dutch Harbor right now as we speak for a shot at being a greenhorn on a crab boat when the odds are pretty good they're going to get a finger torn out, maybe make no money at all,
or die.
Maybe die.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, to let those kinds of people have 30 minutes of unscripted content on a show that airs in 220 countries and be okay with the fact that we don't know how it's going to end, that was a very, very, very difficult sell. But once we did it, once we got it out there, well, I mean, it changed TV.
Literally
that show went from, I mean, there are 33 shows that evolved out of Dirty Jobs. And,
wow.
You know, I don't want the credit or the blame for any of them, but, but to get something on the air that was utterly new, I think I'm probably still answering your first question, and I'm sorry about that.
No, it's relevant. Fine. It's all relevant.
What kind of observations did you after all of these job experiences? Why were they? Why were they?
Why were they happier? Well, you know, I mean, I hate to generalize, but, you know, I have to. In general, mm-hmm. I think job satisfaction today has really been turned inside out.
Right.
I don't think people understand what it is. But I know that most of the dirty jobbers I met took a lot of satisfaction in the fact that they always knew how they were doing. Right? You could stop them at, you know, 10 in the morning, 2 in the afternoon, didn't matter. But the nature of that kind of work gives you constant feedback, right? It's the difference between being at a desk or being on a mission, being in the field, mm-hmm. or, you know, being back at HQ. Your desk, you know, most people's desks look a lot, they look the same at the end of the day as they do at the beginning.
Right.
So you don't have like a big obvious visual cue as to how you're doing. But if you're digging an opal mine, or if you're repairing and replacing bricks in a sewer, or if you're you can just go down the list.
Right.
If you're building a bridge, if you're welding, you know, task-oriented jobs have a way of constantly informing you about your progress. And people need to know how they're doing, but so much of what passes for work today doesn't come with that particular element.
Wow.
So, you know, that was a big part of it. But the even bigger part has to do with passion.
Yes.
You know, we tell kids today, you know, to follow your passion. You know, follow your passion. And we tell them that because passion is important. But dirty jobbers, interestingly, by and large, were all very passionate about their work, but they didn't follow their passion to their job. They took it with them.
Yeah.
Like, I knew this. I met a guy in Wisconsin years ago, Les Swanson from Wisconsin. He was a septic tank cleaner. You know, he was 50, 58, 59 when I met him. It was 10 years ago. And, you know, he's one of these guys. He's got four honey wagons, a dozen employees, and he drives around cleaning the pumping stations on sides of roads. Most people, they don't know what these things are. They look just like little innocuous buildings. But you go through a door, and then you go through another door, and then you go down some stairs, and you are in
the pit of hell. Dante's Inferno.
Dude, it's truly seventh level stuff, you know, and I'm down there with Les. It's 110. We're knocking cholesterol off the walls with shovels, standing up to our nipples and other people's crap.
Wow.
And I said, dude, you know, what happened to you? How'd you get here? And he's like, well, you know, my other job wasn't working for me. I wanted to try something else. I said, well, what were you doing? And he said, I was a psychiatrist.
And no.
You've got to be kidding me. And I said, why'd you quit? You know, and without missing a beat, sweat running down his face, Les looks at me and says, because I was tired of dealing with other people's shit. And I'm like, you know, ha ha, it was very funny. You know, we had a great laugh. But I said, you know, keep going. I'm serious. I want to understand. I'm basically asking him the same question you're asking me, right? Except we're on TV.
Yeah.
And he says, listen, I didn't look for a job to make me happy. I looked to see where everybody was going. What direction is everyone headed? And I went in the opposite direction. And nobody wants to do what I'm doing, but I'm making 300 grand a year.
Wow.
I have half a dozen employees. I got a summer home. I got a margarita machine by my pool, which he does. He took me there later that same day. But, you know, to have a guy basically say, listen, your job satisfaction can't be the thing that drives you to your wish fulfillment. The thing that drives you should be the existence of opportunity. Once you identify that opportunity, now it's incumbent upon you to figure out how to be great at it. Then it's incumbent upon you to figure out a way to love it. And if you can do that, if you can turn opportunity inside out and look at, if you can bring your passion with you, no matter what it is you do, then you're going to be passionate. But
right.
If you tell yourself, like so many kids today, you know, they go to college because they've been told, here's what you need to do. You need to borrow the money. You need to get the degree. You need to identify the thing you want to do with the rest of your life. And then you're going to spend years doing all of the things you have to do in order to allow yourself to be happy on a job that probably won't even exist by the time you get qualified to do it.
Totally.
So, you know, the biggest lesson of dirty jobs was turning the stereotypes and the misperceptions and the myths about the basic reality of work, you know, turning that inside out and challenging them every night on an oil derrick or in a bituminous coal mine or an opal mine or a sewer or any of the other places we went. That was that really was a privilege, and to this day, it's the best thing I've done.
Wow,
that's brilliant! What interesting insight.
That lends credence to how good you are at what you do. Because I didn't put it together at first, but you're right. You didn't know how people were going to react when you put them on the spot, right? When they're the important one. Because just look what happens when you're at a football game or a basketball game and somebody sees themselves on a Jumbotron. It's either shooting the finger or freaking out, or they just stall at the door. Whatever happens when a camera lens turns on somebody, everything goes wash, right?
But
the way you got around that is you put them in their environment, because work brings us all together.
Exactly right.
There is satisfaction in doing something nobody else wants to do. We did that for a living.
Yeah, we did.
I mean, that's kind of
the
prideful
life.
Yeah, that's the prideful part about it. I was like, why do you do this? Because nobody else can.
It sure wasn't the $32,000 a year I was making, that's for sure.
I mean, some people you talk to, if it's, they got a big family or if it's whatever their hobby are, that's what drives them. So they're passionate no matter what they're doing, as long as it enables them to do what they love.
It's called dignity and it's called purpose. Nice. You know, you guys, whether they're paying you 32 grand a year or 320 grand a year, you know, meaningful work, purposeful work, you know, the other thing, you know, to keep answering your first question, what do these people know? They know that sewer inspectors, electricians, plumbers, you know, they know if they all call in sick for a week, the party's over. You know,
right.
They know the same thing you guys know. You know, there are a lot of jobs that could go away for a week, a month, maybe forever. And, you know, life goes on. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the It's a Wonderful Life effect.
Yeah.
You know, you have to look at people's vocations in terms of what the world would be like if they didn't exist. And, you know, that's why the war on work is so insidious and so nuts. You know, the jobs that we rely upon the most as a society are the same jobs we disparage routinely. I don't have to tell you guys. So 1.5% of the population wears a uniform. 1.5% of the population feed 300 million people three times a day. But
right.
We don't aspire to be farmers. We don't encourage our kids to enlist. We don't encourage them to learn a useful skill. We encourage them to borrow as much money as possible to go to an expensive school to learn something that, while it might be gratifying, is not necessarily going to be useful. And so we've created for ourselves a huge set of problems.
Yes, we have.
Hmm.
Well, Mike, what I want to pivot a little bit, and because obviously you have this, you know, incredible success with Dirty Jobs, and as your career has evolved, it got you into all different types. But what I'm seeing now, with where you're at and moving towards, you still got somebody's got to do it, which is, I think, you know, the core root of what that means. But, you know, you started the way I heard it, which, you know, is crazy with just your 100th episode is coming up here. You got 60 million downloads, which is insane. And then you've got the other show, Returning the Favor. Those are three very different approaches to be bringing a different perspective to people. Why the divergence away from the main focus, or what about you and your life and your career that you learned from all the other stuff that you're trying to implement now with what you're doing?
It's kind of, they all lead to the same place, right?
Yep.
I mean, I hate to rip myself off and do the same thing over and over. So I always try and change the angle of attack, if you will, but some things you can't change. You know, I'll never do a show, for instance, that doesn't incorporate the documentary camera that we used in Dirty Jobs. In other words, somebody's got to do it. Dirty Jobs and Returning the Favor all show the viewer what it looks like to make that particular show.
Right.
Right. Mm. So Returning the Favor is basically a rumination on decency. Dirty Jobs was a rumination on work. Somebody's got to do it was a rumination on passion and purpose. But the way I heard it, you know, is just a podcast that I write, classic storytelling, Paul Harvey type stuff.
Right.
About biography and history that I think gets lost and I think people might enjoy. But in the end,
super interesting,
if you peel back the onion layers, it's all I do. I'm 56 years old, and it occurred to me the other day, for the last 20 years, I have been doing the same show in the sense that my job is to tap the country on the shoulder and say, hey, check him out, or get a load of her, or wait till you see what they're doing over here. It still goes back to the first lesson of Dirty Jobs. Stop being a host and start being an avatar or a cipher, right?
Yep.
You know, so I don't really do anything, guys. Except
what would you say you do here? I'm a people person, damn it! What would you say you do here?
Oh my God!
Greatest movie ever. I mean,
look, one of you guys said it before, David. I think it was you. You said, you know, the business of seeking knowledge, the business of seeking understanding.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. It's not finding it. It's seeking it. That's the journey. That's the, you know, Dirty Jobs was the Rosetta Stone of TV for me, because it unlocked this idea that said, wait a second, what if I stop measuring myself by my ability to succeed or master a thing and turn it around so I get paid for merely trying, right?
Right.
It's kind of a fatalistic way to look at life in a sense, but on the other hand, it's just TV. And if I could figure out a way to host a show where I'm not going to be criticized for my technique or criticized for failing, but only held to a standard of seeking or attempting, you know, that was good for me. So that's just a very long way of saying that what I do is manage expectations.
I love that. I love that.
I think that that's very humble in a sort of way, almost a self-deprecating presentation there, but you are definitely filling a role out there. I mean, people don't get invited to testify, for example, before a Senate committee for no reason at all. You used a term a minute ago, and just slightly shift gears, war on work. Is that, mm-hmm. did I hear you correctly? Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, it's a cold war, you know, when people aren't, you know, affirmatively, you know, sitting down and, you know, twirling their mustaches and laughing maniacally at some giant plan to destroy the Puritan work ethic. But over the last 40 years, it's happened. You know, you can see it in pop culture. You can look around at the most successful TV shows and see the portrayals of working people. I mean, if there's a plumber on a show, five will get you 20 that he's 300 pounds, you know, with a butt crack hanging out, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what plumbers look like on TV. The best-selling books, you know, are the 4-hour work week, right? You know, how to work less and achieve more. So there's nothing wrong with efficiency. I'm a big fan of it, but I'm a bigger fan of effectiveness. And I think that we've fallen in love with efficiency to the point that it's like the old platitude, work smart, not hard. What a crock.
Right.
You know? I mean, working smart and working hard are the underpinnings of effectiveness. Working smart without working hard is
cheating.
You know, essentially a robot.
Impedes human performance. I mean, kind of get...
Yeah. Well, Huxley, right?
Yeah.
In Brave New World, Huxley said, the greatest enemy of freedom is anarchy, but the second greatest enemy is efficiency.
Right.
And, you know, I didn't think much about it when I read it. I was too young, but now it's like, holy crap. You know,
big.
If you take efficiency to its logical conclusion, who needs humans?
Well, artificial intelligence, there's a big horizon coming up with artificial intelligence and what's going to happen with that.
Yeah, people are scared because, you know, the further we get from traditional notions of work, the more untethered we become from meaningful labor.
Mm-hmm.
And so the war on work, as I perceived it, really came down to the perceptions and stereotypes that people held for the dirty jobbers that I featured on the show.
Right.
And, you know, debunking those myths is the purpose of the foundation that evolved out of Dirty Jobs that I run to this day. you know, that's why I go to Congress. That's why I talk to companies large and small, mm-hmm. because companies are failing to effectively recruit. They're just not sure how to do it anymore. Look, we got 6.3 million jobs available right now. 75% of them don't require a four-year degree. They require training. They require the mastery of a skill that's in demand. Meanwhile, you got $1.5 trillion in student loans currently on the books, and you've got millions of college graduates who are perfectly trained for jobs that don't exist anymore. So the infrastructure is falling down, and we just aren't quite sure why there are these massive shortages in these really, really important areas. It's true. There's just no getting around it. If the construction industry is so far back on its heels right now, they just can't find people who are willing to show up early, stay late, learn a useful skill, and then move up the ladder. So it's a problem, and it's not going to get better by accident. We have to do something.
One of the things that I truly love about, you know, what helps bringing the message, right? You're bringing the narrative. That's your job. You bringing the narrative of the importance of these things to people around the world, literally. What about the people? Like, let's just take it. Let's whittle it down back to the core of what our show's about. Do you remember some great never quit stories about the people you've interviewed? Like, wherever, you know, in whatever job that they were down and out, they were almost gone, they were almost done, sure. And they found something that gave them that purpose. Would you share maybe one great or two great ones that you remember?
I'll give you, I mean, look, I can give you 300, but I'll give you two terrific ones.
Perfect.
Imagine you can.
There was a guy called Matt Freund who had a dairy farm in New Canaan up in Connecticut. He had a couple hundred head of cattle, and this was been 2004, I guess. And he was struggling. The price of milk was not favorable. The cost of running the farm was exorbitant, and he was slowly going a little further under every month. And you know, he's raising a family, and it's very difficult to pivot when you're a farmer.
Yeah.
You know, you're beholden to the land. You're beholden to your livestock, and in this case, you're beholden to the price of milk and cheese, both of which were not good. So Matt, being kind of a mad scientist, figured out a device, a digester, and a fixed film reactor that essentially let him heat his house with cow shit. And absolutely brilliant.
Brilliant.
Right?
But, brilliant.
You know,
so he starts saving money in a very practical way. But then he's out mowing his lawn and trimming the hedges and stuff, and you know, the fertilizer he'd been using, all that cow crap, was really working wonderfully. You know, his garden was going crazy. So he thought, you know, and this is like, I don't have this chip. I don't have this. This is just not in my makeup. But it would never occur to me to ask the question that he asked, which was, wait a minute, these flower pots that you can buy at Walmart, you know, they're made of cardboard. But what if they were made of cow shit? Like, what if you put dirt in a flower pot that was made of high octane fertilizer, and that began to biodegrade into the dirt itself? Would that help your plants grow? Well, the answer is hell yeah.
Wow.
So long story short, Matt Freund woke up one morning and realized the milk from his cows was less valuable than their shit. And he built an entire business making these, he called them poo pots. And like, when I heard about this story from a neighbor of his, I took the crew and we went over there to spend a day with Matt making these poo pots. That show went on the air. Somebody at Walmart saw it, and Matt made a deal. Matt's doing just fine now.
Wow!
But he had to think completely differently about who he was, about what his business really was, and who his customer actually was. So, you know, if you're able to do that, if you're able to step completely outside of yourself and take the temperature of the room in a non-traditional way, you might find a way out of virtually any problem.
Wow, that's amazing. What a great story.
Yeah,
what an incredible story.
Yeah, brother, you really, I mean, it's kind of the center of the hourglass when it comes to the people who watch and the people who work. I mean, it's like an insight nobody has, or very few people have, over the years, just getting in the trenches with everybody, man. It's enlightening, I would imagine, just from what we do, or what I do, to travel around and Rhett and I, and speaking and getting to hang out with
everybody,
all walks of
life.
Dude,
are you kidding? It is access. You know, I took it for granted early on, but access is the thing.
Yes.
You know, to bear witness, you know, for the 130 job, we went, I mean, look, I'm obviously a fan of what you guys do, and I'm a big fan of the armed forces, and I wanted the 100th job to be Army. You know, I just thought, why not? So we went to Fort Jackson down there in one of the Carolinas, North Carolina, I think. 187th Battalion, fixed wheel battalion, you know, basically the mechanics, you know, who can change your tire while they're getting shot at. So, I mean, I've profiled, you know, the Army, the Seabees, those guys.
That's great.
Construction workers. We build, right?
Yeah, they make war tolerable, man.
Yeah, I mean, it's so to have access, you know, to have a couple of, you know, Air Force guys take me into a KC-135R, you know, the strato tanker, to replace a fuel cell in a possibly cramped place covered with high octane fuel. It wasn't on my bucket list, but having done it, I would not trade that experience for anything. You know, cleaning the inside of buoys, you know, the buoy tenders for the Coast Guard. The access is truly the gift of that show. And you're right, Marcus. I mean, it's absurd how many opportunities I've had to watch people who are truly great at what they do and learn from them.
You get to do stuff, money. It's not money can't buy it.
Yeah,
there's not enough money to they can pay you. I mean, when you get in there and you get to experience everybody's life on their level, and they're willing to share that with you because you're willing to get in there and work with them or bleed for them like we do. That's kind of the American dream, in my opinion. That's the reward. It's something that you hear about, people talking about, and that's why people come here. But when you finally get a chance to see it, man, it's mind blowing.
It's humbling. I look for big themes, right? So Dirty Jobs, like I said, was fundamentally about work. Returning the favor is fundamentally about decency. And, you know, I'm wary of all earnestness, right? So I don't want to do an earnest show, but I do want to do a show that elevates and celebrates and rewards the kind of behavior I think we all like to encourage. My newsfeed on Facebook is just a hot mess of, you know, angry people unfriending each other and bitching about everything in the world.
It's crazy.
It's crazy. Cable news would depress a hyena, you know? I mean, it's just everybody's veins are bulging and the spit's flying through the air and everybody's so pissed off about everything. So I said to Facebook, look, let's do a really simple show where we find people slightly better than you or I, and let's get to know them, let's understand what they're doing, and then let's give them something that allows them to do more of it. So that's what Returning the Favor is. It's been viewed 300 million times so far. We've done 30 episodes. It's working.
Awesome.
So having said all that, you know, the first thing I wanted to do in that show was go back to the military, found a guy in Crown Point, Indiana, named Jason Zademan, who was doing something called hot rod therapy. He was taking guys with PTSD and repairing old motorcycles and having enormous success, you know, getting them out of their heads a little bit, focused on something else, you know, that task driven, you know, right?
Mission orientation.
Mission oriented. That's exactly right. And so the thing is, though, Jason doesn't know his ass from a hot rock when it comes to fixing motorcycles. It's hysterical. So he's learning as he goes. He's literally watching YouTube videos with these guys, and they're rehabbing old bikes. So that was the first segment we did, and it went so well that I said to the producers, look, I want to go back and do something with the military at least every third or fourth episode.
Wow.
Which we've done. Like, we've done, the Semper Canine, which trains dogs,
yep.
You know, for service dogs for vets. But Travis was my favorite. Travis
yeah.
Mills has a retreat that he built up in Maine. If your listeners don't know, back in 2000, whatever it was, Trav put his backpack down on a bomb. It blew up. Both legs, he was, I think, maybe the first quadruple amputee
right.
To make it back. And he clawed his way back in ways that I just, you know, his book, I think it's called As Tough As They Come.
Yep.
He's the ultimate never quit guy. If you That's haven't remarkable. Had him on, you really should.
I've reached out like 10 times and I'm going to keep reaching out. He's amazing.
You know what? I'll send him a note. Too,
oh, because, Mike, that would be awesome.
He's busy, and what he's doing up there in Maine is freaking incredible, man. He basically raised enough money through his foundation, bought a chunk of land with this old estate on it, like the Estee Lauder estate, and he's opened it up to vets in his exact same position and their families, right? Because so often the families
yep.
get arbitraged out of the whole equation. So, you know, his wife stood by him, and he really wanted to do something for the families of vets who were, you know, clawing their way back. So we went up there and built a ropes course.
Wow.
We got him out of town for a night or two and built this very elaborate ropes course that was, you know, a couple stories high, because he really wants to challenge people to, you know, push themselves, get out of their comfort zone. And, you know, I knew Travis from the old days, and he saw the course, and he started crying, and I started crying, and we started laughing because we're, you know, what the hell, what a bunch of pussies crying like this on Facebook. But you know what? It was just a great story. And, you know, 10 million people saw it.
It's my favorite.
And now it's actually moving the needle. Which, again, is just a very long way of saying the stories are all around us.
Yes.
You know, whether you're in a podcast or a TV show or a Facebook show, searching for real, authentic people who are passionate about whatever it is they're doing and determined to make a difference along the way, that's what's for sale. And Travis Mills wrote the book on it.
Amen. Well, before we wrap up, we always ask our guests, and you know, you have such a profound insight on not only hard work, but the human condition itself in terms of all your quest to try and understand that, right? What could you share with the people that are listening right now that are struggling, that are challenged, that are maybe in that dark space a little bit, don't know what to do or where to go, where to turn to? What could you offer them that could be that little spark that just gets them back in the fight a little bit?
Look, to me, they're two really important groups of people. There's the group of people you just described, and they need a hand. They need encouragement, right? Mm-hmm. But there's a larger group, and that group is as important, because they're not down and they're not out, but they're not in either. They're not engaged.
Mm-hmm.
They're not present. Right. They're stumbling through their life. They're not miserable, but they're just not really alive. And those are the people that I'm interested in both groups, obviously, but I feel like I'm in a position to maybe make a difference with that group. And to the extent that my shows have a recurring theme, I think it's probably to look around and find the uncomfortable thing and then do it.
Wow.
The way out is almost never comfortable.
Amen.
You should be very suspicious of comfort. You should be very suspicious of earnestness. You should be very suspicious, you know, counterintuitively, of advice. It's the easiest thing in the world to give, and that's why I try not to,
to
give it in terms of, hey, let me tell you what I've figured out. Here's what you need to do. Who the hell am I? I don't know what you need to do. You know, I mean, I don't know. But I'll tell you something. There's most good advice turns to shit over time because good advice becomes homogenized. Homogenization leads to platitudes. Platitudes become bromides. And before you know it, good advice winds up in these cheap frames nailed to the rooms of conference halls all over corporate America.
And so the next thing
you know, you're looking at something that says, always follow your passion. And it's a picture of like a waterfall and some asshole in a kayak, you know, paddling along. And there's a rainbow and then there's a freaking unicorn. And I don't know what any of it means, but the next thing you know, you're telling your kids, son, you get out there, you follow your passion. Well, bullcrap. You don't follow your passion. You take it with you. You know? And so it's so easy to take kernels of knowledge and then put them in a frame or between two hardback covers and say, aha, we have the answer for you. And then we just vomit all that stuff up, you know, like one size fits all. It doesn't. You know, there are very few things that truly can be said that apply to everyone under the rubric of good advice. And so I'm stingy with it, but I'm comfortable saying, if it's comfortable, be suspicious. If it's earnest, somebody's selling you something. If it hurts, you might be onto something, right?
Amen.
So, you know, I'm not trying to be a total contrarian about it, but if you look at the way our society deals with safety, when you look at the premium we put on safety, when you look at the way we've completely made risk the thing to avoid, right? We've just done so many things. I mean, why are we surprised that our universities are full of safe spaces? We've created the whole place as a safe space. You know, we've just discouraged people from putting real skin in the game. And so, look, this has really been a fun conversation, but it's kind of a hot mess of things that keeps coming back around to the idea that you have to be suspicious of the easy way. There are no shortcuts. There's no way forward without discomfort. And if you're in a place where you're feeling uncomfortable, don't look at the discomfort as the enemy. Look at it as a symptom. Hopefully something that you can use. And don't be afraid to admit that maybe everything you thought you knew was wrong. Have a peripeteia, you know? Remember Matt Freund. He woke up one day and realized his shit was more valuable than his milk. That's a heck of a thing to realize when you're in the cow business.
That's a hell of a thing.
That is a peripeteia. Right.
So anyway, there it is.
Well, awesome. Wow. Awesome. Listen, sir, we can't thank you enough. Before you go, can you just touch real quick on your foundation and what you're trying to do and where people can go to apply and that sweat pledge you got? I think it's genius, and I just would love if you could just touch real quick on that before we end it.
Yeah, look, my foundation's modest, you know, compared to big ones anyway. We give away $600,000-$700,000 a year in the form of work ethic scholarships. To get a work ethic scholarship, you need to be willing to learn a skill that's actually in demand. Welding, plumbing, pipe fitting. If you go to microworks.org, you can read about the available programs. You can apply. We're in the midst right now of taking applications, and we'll puke up the money probably in June. We do this every year. We've given away about $5 million so far. I raise the money by going to corporations and making them feel guilty until they give me some. Sometimes, you know, I've auctioned off God knows how much crap in my garage, all of which comes with a weird story and an autograph, and people overpay for that. So the money comes from all sorts of different places, and in order to get a scholarship, you need to jump through some hoops, you know. You need to make a video. You need to write an essay. You need to sign the sweat pledge. The sweat pledge is a 12-point pledge that I wrote probably 7 years ago after a six-pack and Maryland blue crabs, funnily enough. Back in Baltimore, eating crabs with my dad and talking about delayed gratification and all the stuff I wanted to do with the foundation. And with a slight buzz on, I sat down and wrote 12 things that I absolutely believe to be true. And I really don't want to give money to people who don't agree with me. I don't mind if you don't agree with me, but as I say to people every day, this particular pile of free money might not be for you. and so that's the way it works. You know,
awesome.
You sign the sweat pledge. I still think a person's word is important. So, you know, it's a pledge. It stands for skills and work ethic aren't taboo. Sweat. You sign it, you agree with it, you apply, and if it works out, we send you some money, and the next thing you know, you're making a living up in the high plains working on heavy equipment or welding on an oil derrick down in the Gulf or doing one of those dirty jobs that really changed my career. And least I can do in the way of a legacy. I know that's kind of an earnest word, but, you know, if Dirty Jobs has a legacy beyond my own good fortune, it's the chance to talk to guys like you and to offer some help to people who still aren't afraid to get their hands dirty.
Well, sir, your words do have meaning, and more importantly, your actions and what you've done for most particularly our country and for just millions of souls out there, giving them that inspiration. We are just so proud and honored to have you on to share your story and your beliefs, and God bless you and all that you're doing, Mike. We just can't thank you enough.
Well, look, you humble me and even embarrass me a little bit, because what you guys do and what your brothers and sisters in arms have done is the only thing that really matters. Every word I say, every thought I have, every freedom I enjoy was paid for dearly by the likes of you guys. So many thanks to you as well, and we should do it again sometime.
We'd love it. We'd love it.
Fortunate to have guys like you out there, Mike.
Likewise, fellas.
Keep charging forward, brother.
Yeah.
You're doing great.
Likewise.
Take
right,
care.
Matt,
God
well.
Bless. Yep. Bye-bye. Yep.
You too. See ya.
Marcus, brother, is that dude one of the coolest dudes you've ever heard in your whole life?
You know, that 0 to 40 opinion, 40 to 70 is perspective, and that's hopefully wisdom.
Yeah.
He got it early.
He got it super early, didn't it? I mean, 300 dirty job shows. 300, bro. I mean, you think about the perspective he has, not only on work and what work means, but what it takes to work, the human condition.
Oh man, when you get out there and suffer with somebody, no matter what the job is, you kind of create that bond, become a family. I mean, he's integrated into 300 different types of job descriptions. You can't walk out of there without being changed, right?
A little totally.
Bit, taking something away from them. The good and the bad, right? And it just kind of molds you into what he is. And he's so fluid in the way he talks about everything that you know is genuine. And, man, that's a lifetime of diplomas on your back wall that...
Great visual, man.
Can't get anywhere
else, you know
what I mean?
Of diplomas, dude.
That's good.
That is perfect. What I also love about the guy, right, is his, the like you just touched on, the genuine thing he realizes, not only about himself, but about what his mission is, what his purpose is, right, Wizard? Is his purpose mm-hmm. is not to be famous, is not to be the center of attention.
Exactly. What I really liked was he first found himself a niche and created it with Dirty Jobs, not knowing where it was going to carry him. And through that whole process, he builds this appreciation, goes to this metamorphosis of, he discovers an entire wealth of experience that he didn't even know was out there to appreciate in the first place.
Yep.
And then,
and shared it with all of us.
And then he appreciates it, and then he uses it. He starts using it to affect change far greater than himself, far greater than his personal gain. Just, you know, am I going to have another TV show? Am I going to be popular? Is my Instagram feed going to grow by another X amount of viewers? Just so impressive in that way.
Right? It doesn't. Mm-hmm. It's not what's important. What's important to him is the stalwarts of what make people strong, right? Which is a work ethic, a desire to improve their surroundings, humility, decency, these core foundations of what make America strong, what his grandfather taught him, man. That's what I love most about it, right, Marcus?
Yeah, man, that passed down, and you know, he's proud of him now.
Heck yeah, he is. Heck yeah, he is.
I like that being the trigger point in that whole story, how he described that. It'd be nice if he could see you actually, what did he say? It'd be nice
do
if he could
work.
See you do some work.
Yeah.
Got that done, brother.
Oh, man, I love it.
And one other thing is, at the end there, when he was talking about, he kind of distilled it down in the points of advice that you asked him about. And he says, if it's something that hurts, you might be onto something. You know, be suspicious of what's comfortable or taking shortcuts. And that reminded me of what Dom Rosso said and what's become something that's stuck in my head since he said it, was that if he's confronted with a decision to make, and if he doesn't make it in the first 5 seconds, he just defaults to choosing whatever is less comfortable and the benefit of doing so.
Right? Right?
Yeah.
And that's that. And in that lies this discovery, right? And
exactly. It takes you down roads you
never dreamed.
Yeah. You don't know what you don't know.
With almost absolute certainty, because nobody else is going to want to do it.
Exactly.
And if there is somebody who jumps down there with you, strap on, yeah, hang on to them, man. That's,
there you go.
There's your new buddy.
And that's your team that's your to right improve there. And grow with, man. God, there's so many lessons that this man can teach us or show us, right? I mean, and what I love is his humility, too. The guy is so well-read. He understands history. I mean, his podcast is remarkable, too. I love listening to that. You know, just his and in his commitment to not marginalizing what has built this country. And I love. So, you know, before we wrap things up, what I really want to do is I want to read that sweat pledge.
Do it, right? Man.
Because I think it's more than just a scholarship, you know, within his foundation. If everybody,
okay,
could sign the sweat pledge, We'd turn this thing around, wouldn't we, Marcus?
That's all good. Right. Yeah, let's hear it.
All right, here we go. Skill and work ethic aren't taboo. That's what the acronym sweat means, right? Number one, I believe that I have won the greatest lottery of all time. I am alive, right? I say that every day, right? I'm above dirt. I am alive. I walk the earth. I live in America. Above all things, I am grateful. Number two, I believe that I am entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Nothing more. I also understand that happiness and the pursuit of happiness are not the same thing. Number three, I believe there is no such thing as a bad job. I believe that all jobs are opportunities, and it's up to me to make the best of them. Number four, I do not follow my passion. I bring it with me. I believe that any job can be done with passion and enthusiasm. Five, I deplore debt and do all I can to avoid it. I would rather live in a tent and eat beans than borrow money to pay for a lifestyle I can't afford. Six, I believe that my safety is my responsibility. I understand that being in compliance does not necessarily mean I am out of danger. 7. I believe the best way to distinguish myself at work is to show up early, stay late, and cheerfully volunteer for every crappy task there is. 8. I believe the most annoying sounds in the world are whining and complaining. I will never make them. If I am unhappy at my work, I will either find a new job or find a way to be happy. 9. I believe that my education is my responsibility and absolutely critical to my success. I am resolved to learn as much as I can from whatever source is available to me. I will never stop learning and understand that library cards are free. 10. I believe that I am a product of my choices, not my circumstances. I will never blame anyone for my shortcomings or the challenges I face. And I will never accept the credit for something I didn't do. 11. I understand the world is not fair, and I am okay with that. I do not resent the success of others. 12. I believe that all people are created equal. I also believe that all people make choices. Some choose to be lazy. Some choose to sleep in. I choose to work my butt off. Those are the 12 steps of the sweat pledge, baby. And boy, do I love Marcus. Are those awesome, dude?
We need to go to Grumpy's, man. That was pretty profound.
All right, and that happened. Actually, he wrote that one, Eating Crabs. He wrote the treatment for Dirty Jobs and Grumpy's.
Oh, that's right.
I think we need to make a trip.
Either way.
I think the three of us go to Grumpy's and we come up the treatment for our job to go do the Never Quit TV show. What do you think?
Yeah, man, that was profound.
It was.
You ever wondered if you stand up and you give your word you're going to do something? If you ever, what needed to come behind that?
Yeah.
Tack those on.
Amen.
So stand tall.
You will.
Just kind of like some guidelines just to get through it.
Those and are.
Be successful. Be happy. All that other
pretty
stuff.
Pretty much all that other stuff.
Yeah, that comes along with it.
Well, that's all we got for this show, man. I am so fired up. That was one of my favorite all time. I am so thankful to Mike for coming on and sharing his wisdom with us, sharing his life and his never quit mindset and story. I want to thank, man, our listeners. Thank you so much for believing in what we're doing, helping us do our part in sharing the human condition and what's possible within it with the world around us. I want to thank God and Christ for the influence in my life, my girls, the endless sunshine in my life. I want to thank my family and friends. I want to thank the SEAL teams for teaching me how to work and have a work ethic. And gents, I want to thank you too, because, you know, we're putting in the work to bring this show to millions of people. And I want to thank your commitment to me and to our listeners and to what we're doing here. I couldn't do it without you too. So thank you, gents.
Right back at you, bud.
Again, Mike, thanks for coming on. That was amazing. I learned a lot from that one, and I know everybody else will. It's just so unique in the way you've achieved all of that perspective, and kind of down in the trenches. A lot of people can relate to that, man. It's giving them a path, center of the hourglass, looking through both sides of it, man. That's really something. And to, you know, my mom and dad and my brother for giving me my work ethic. It's the one thing that's made me successful is my ability to work hard. So thank you for that, and for everybody who keeps bringing us back. We truly can't thank you enough, man. We just don't have the words. I'm out.
Out.
Never quit. Team Never Quit Radio.